The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Based at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy, where she was the founding executive director, Samantha Power is the Anna Lindt Professor of Practice of Global Leadership and Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Her book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, was awarded the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, the 2003 National Book Critics Circle Award for General Nonfiction, and the Council on Foreign Relations Arthur Ross Prize for the Best Book in U.S. Foreign Policy. In her new book, Chasing the Flame, Ms. Power renders a stirring portrait of Sergio Vieira de Mello, the Brazilian diplomat killed by a suicide bomber while working as the U.N. Secretary General's special representative in Iraq, as well as his powerful legacy of humanity and ideological strength. I am lucky to be part of the team that is making a feature documentary on Chasing the Flame. It is a harrowing story. We are honored to have her here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Samantha Power.
Thanks. Thank you. It's great to be here in Pennsylvania, as well as Philadelphia. You all get to break the tie. And I'm going to talk tonight for about 25 minutes or a half an hour about Sergio, this amazing figure, global figure. And then in the question period, I'd love to encourage you to ask about anything that is on your mind. Zimbabwe, Iran, that Darfur, the election, Monstergate. Yeah, my blunder is fair game for life, it seems. Anyway, it's always a pleasure for me to be at libraries in general, but it's a special pleasure for me to be at this library where Lynda Johnson has done such an unbelievable job galvanizing the expansion of the library, the creation of these new spaces, the support for the space that already exists. It's just unbelievable. And what is so great about her vision for this library and that of the other people who are behind this effort is that it is responsive to a moment in this country where people are hungering for adult conversations about a range of issues. And libraries, while also being a place where people squirrel up with the books of their choice, are in fact some of the few social and public and civic spaces in our country. And I'm sure this was true before 9/11, but I know that since 9/11, everyone remembers on 9/11 and the aftermath and how people just, they lined up so desperate to engage, so desperate to be a part of the healing of those who were in such pain that they literally lined up to give blood. I mean, that's how desperate they were to join the effort, to do something. And I think that hunger, that desire to be a part of something bigger than ourselves is something that this incredible presidential election has tapped into. You're seeing it now in the state with these registration drives and the vast number of people who've never voted before who've engaged. But also what libraries are becoming again in communities, I think, is responsive to this desire to kind of come together and be more than we have managed to be in a while. Sergio was not American, not part of this space as such. But I've come to think of him as the most important person, most important man most of you have never heard of. He was described to me when I met him first in 1994 as a cross between James Bond on the one hand and Bobby Kennedy on the other. Bond, I think, in retrospect, because he was like a moth to the flame. He chased the flame of war, of violence. He was he negotiated with the world's worst killers over the course of the last four decades. And also Bond-like because he was, you know, he was a man for the ladies. He had he was a charmer of women. Also Bond-like because while he didn't have a kind of Q in his corner giving him gadgets, he was a person who managed to use smoke and mirrors sometimes to conjure up solutions when it wasn't obvious that they could be found, when resources were scarce, and he would sort of bluff his way toward convincing people that there was more behind him than there actually was. I think he was Bobby Kennedy-like in retrospect because he was not simply an idealist, which he was, but he was a Machiavellian idealist. I remember Arthur Schlesinger's great line on the difference between Bobby Kennedy and John F. Kennedy, that John F. Kennedy was an idealist masquerading as a realist, and Bobby was a realist masquerading as an idealist. Sergio is somewhere in between, but his commitment to civilian protection, to non-aggression, to the prevention of sectarian violence, ethnic conflict, etc., dignity, which I'll talk about a little bit later, these commitments were his core commitments. And then he was willing to do deals with devils if that's what was required in order to get at those commitments. He was willing to negotiate with just about anybody, as I'll again discuss. So that's how he was introduced to me. But the reason this book came about is that in August of 2003, of course, he was killed by a suicide bomber, Christina, heroically helping produce an incredible documentary about the very last stage of Sergio's life, that August 19th attack. And I knew Sergio. We were friends, not good friends. But when I began to grieve the loss of a friend, I also began to read more about somebody I had known in passing over the years in conflict areas. And every obituary I read or every reflection about him, I learned something new about his biography. I realized that he'd been in so many more places than he had ever let on, had negotiated with so many more killers than I'd ever even known that he would have had the capacity to encounter in a relatively young life. And it struck me, the more time that passed since his death in August of 2003, and the more I read, that what had been lost was not only a friend and not only a great guy and a savvy guy and a go-to guy in the UN system, but it was somebody who had been a receptacle for learning about how to deal with violence and the violent, how to deal with brokenness, how to deal with failing states, repressive states, states that were committing atrocities, militants, that all of this was in him. And that if someone didn't come along and kind of go back over the record, that a lot of that learning and that knowledge would be lost with him, that it would lay in the rubble, in a sense, in Baghdad. So what I've come to learn, which I never would have known just as encountering Sergio in the field over the years, was a remarkable biography where he was in something like 14 conflict areas, where he spoke seven languages. He was a Brazilian, as many of you know. Father was a Brazilian diplomat, and Sergio probably would have followed in his father's footsteps, but in the mid-1960s, the Brazilian military took over the government there in a coup. Sergio's dad was forced into an early retirement. Sergio convinced himself that this was for political reasons. As a teenager, there were other issues. His dad, looks like, was also an alcoholic, and that was a factor. It's very hard to tell what was his politics and what was his performance. But for Sergio, it was all about politics. And his nascent leftism grew more and more radical in his teenage years, culminating in his participation in May of 1968 in the Paris riots against the state, against the university, the Sorbonne, where Sergio had gone to study political philosophy. He wore his leftism in those days loudly. If he heard If you saw an American car passing on the street with American license plate, or American make, not American license plate, but if it was an American-made car, he would bend over and act as though he was picking up stones and make a motion as if he was hurling them at the car. I mean, he was really shrill and green in a lot of different ways. When he graduated from the Sorbonne with this degree in philosophy, first in his class, he was at a crossroads, couldn't go back to Brazil because of his leftism, having been caught up in the riots, beaten up badly, arrested, etc., with a right-wing government, military government in charge. Couldn't teach philosophy as a foreigner, as a Brazilian, in Paris or in Europe. Didn't feel he could anyway. And began looking for a place in the world where he could park his ideals and actually see them implemented. And ended up, as people of that generation often did, at the door of the United Nations. He was hired at age 21 by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, spent the 1970s in basically wherever the headlines moved over the course of the next 30 years, he would move. So in the 70s, it was wars of decolonization, wars of independence. His first mission was to Bangladesh, the largest population movement in recorded history up to that point. He was responsible for caring for the refugees, figuring out how to house them. First mission made a huge impression on him. Then he went to Sudan, where it looked like the civil war there was coming to an end. It would later restart, and that's the one that we're still dealing with to this day. He goes to Cyprus in the wake of the Turkish invasion, to Mozambique, which was undergoing its own population movements, the residue of the War of Independence that Mozambique had just gone through, and then the influx of Zimbabweans or Rhodesians, et cetera, flowing into the country. And he had to figure out, how do you care for refugees who come in, but who are also, some of whom are fighters who intend to go back? What's the job of an international civil servant? Refugees are not, don't get that status if they're armed and if they are guerrillas. Grappling with these impossible choices, a turning point mission for him, one that I think turned him from the kind of raw idealist leftist of his youth to someone who began to resemble the Sergio that I would get to know in the 1990s, came in Lebanon, where he served from 1981 to 83. There, the UN peacekeepers served as something of a buffer in southern Lebanon. It's actually a very similar mission to the one that exists today in southern Lebanon, but it's a larger mission in the wake of the 2006 war. But Sergio was part of that mission, and the logic of it was that if you just hung out at the border, that would hopefully, because you were supposedly embodying the will of the world, that would deter PLO fighters from staging raids into northern Israel, and it would deter the Israelis from crossing an international border and attacking the PLO and so forth. Now, it did neither. The raids occurred into northern Israel, and in 82, the Israelis invaded. That was the invasion that would lead to the occupation of Lebanon that would end in only in the year 2000, with many, many Israelis killed in the meantime. And Sergio was part of that buffer force, which was given small arms. There were no countries in the UN that had contributed peacekeepers to that force, thinking that their peacekeepers were going to make war with Israel, or that their peacekeepers were going to disarm the PLO and go into Palestinian or Lebanese houses and take guns and so forth. So this is a recurring theme, countries in the UN, governments, were prepared to commit just enough so that there was a buffer zone, but not enough to really deal with the underlying causes of the conflict, Israeli insecurity and Palestinian dispossession. I mean, ultimately, no one wanted to touch either of those issues, and so that, in a sense, Sergio was part of a mission that was something of a sitting duck. And in June of 82, when the tanks came across the border and rolled over UN facilities and so forth, Sergio went charging up to this Israeli tank captain and said, kind of waving the UN Charter in my mind's eye — I don't think he was actually waving the UN Charter — but this young Brazilian idealist, very eloquent, hugely accomplished already within the UN system, and yet simply working for the UN, goes up to this commander and says, "What you have just done, sir, is unacceptable. You have crossed an international border." And this guy looks at him and says, "Unacceptable? You think this is unacceptable?" I got 50 tanks behind me, and they're coming around the corner. Now that's unacceptable. And Sergio said, a hugely important moment, that from that point forward, he would never use the word unacceptable again. And sure enough, there was a shift. He went from thou shalt not to what's motivating you, to getting in the room, to trying to understand both in Lebanon and beyond, in that instance, Israeli objectives, Palestinian objectives, what were they after? Was there any way to play into their own organic cost-benefit analyses and to try to understand where they were coming from? And then to convey those priorities or those objectives to governments in the United Nations who had the resources to provide troops or police or humanitarian aid or political pressure. Hugely important turning point to go from being a leftist, a guy who wore his leftism loudly and anti-imperialist, to always wanting to deal with state power, to mistrust the state still, but to understand that states weren't going anywhere, governments weren't going anywhere, armies weren't going anywhere. So the question was not how to banish them or how to moralize to them. It was how to somehow get at their perceptions of their own interests. And that then would define, that's when he became a more Bobby Kennedy-like figure, I suppose. The wall fell in 89. Sergio was the person, by this time kind of a legend within the UN system, was the person sent to negotiate with the Khmer Rouge, the first ever international official to go into the jungle. 2 million people had been killed, of course, by the Khmer Rouge. He negotiated then the return of nearly 400,000 Cambodian refugees who were stranded at the Thai-Cambodian border, and made that return happen by getting in the room with the worst of the worst in that region. When I knew him, though, in Bosnia, the next mission, he was in Cambodia for a couple of years and then to Bosnia, not only did he have the Bond Kennedy thing going for him, but he actually was seen to have gone too far, to have become almost Neville Chamberlain-like in his desire to be in the room with everyone, too trusting somehow of harm doers, too trusting in the power of reason in his own political philosophy in some ways. And this sort of suspicion of him went so far as to earn him the nickname not Sergio, but Serbio in the Balkans, not in by any means a highlight of his life's career, but I think a very important period because it was still a time, Cold War again, wall had just fallen, still a notion that peacekeepers and aid workers could see themselves as neutral. Because remember, back in the Lebanon day, the idea was, you're just interpositioning yourself between two Lebanese government, let's say if there had a meaningful government, an army and Israel. Peacekeepers then kind of sort of evolved in the 1990s, but they brought that same mentality that your job is just to interposition yourselves between warring parties. But the problem was, in Bosnia, it was like a Jackson Pollock painting. You know, there were no clear-cut lines where you could just interposition yourself and hope that your presence would constitute a deterrent. And yet it didn't adjust its rules of engagement, the UN, the governments on the UN. Secretary General, believe it or not, itself had no power to adjust those rules. It really came down to the countries on the UN Security Council, and specifically the Permanent Five, Russia, China, the United States, Britain, and France. And they didn't address it. They kind of kept kicking the ball down the field, hoping that, you know, something would turn up. So in some ways, Sergio was just a symptom of a kind of neglect of the commons, a refusal to really grapple with the hard questions that would, the answers to which would define how we manage the post-Cold War world or disorder. After Bosnia, he went to Congo. I mean, most of this I didn't know when he was still alive, and then I just went back. I thought he was there too. He was in Congo, and right in the aftermath of the Rwandan genocide, the genocidaire from Rwanda had fled into neighboring countries and were living intermingled among Hutu civilians. So again, here he's the guy having to decide: do I turn off the spigot of international life support and thus endanger these innocent Hutu civilians, but also hopefully force the genocidaire to leave the border area where they're still planning to murder Tutsi civilians in Rwanda? In other words, they're not done. They're still planning for the next genocide. In fact, they're still armed, so they take the humanitarian aid, they sell it to buy guns and machetes to go back and do their thing. So it seems obvious. Yes, you must turn it off. And yet, the Rwandan government has made it clear that Hutu aren't all that welcome to come back. So what if when they go back, what if they don't go back and they follow the genocidaire into the jungle and die, or there's a cholera outbreak, or they starve? Or what if they go back and then the Rwandan government retaliates for the genocide that has just gone? Well, I won't spoil what Sergio did, but imagine having to answer that question. It was all lesser evils in that period, and I think this is much more like the world that we now live in than our ways of thinking about foreign policy have yet adjusted to. After Congo, nation building is the cause of the day, and Sergio's the guy put in charge of running the mini-country statelet of Kosovo and then that of East Timor. So he's the Bremer figure, the Jerry Bremer figure, insofar as he's got absolute executive, judicial, and legislative powers. He's not a humanitarian. He's not only a politician. He's like a head of state. And there he is presiding over such questions as what the currency should be, the flag, taxation policy, who picks up the garbage, what should be in the textbooks. Now, his approach was to just solicit and extract from local leaders of all sort of very, very diverse leanings their ideas on these things. But still, a foreigner doing all that, and an anti-imperialist, no less. The tensions for him were almost insurmountable. Again, moving with the headlines after 9/11, the United States and its relationship with international law becomes the cause of the day, and he's the guy figuring out, as he becomes UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, what do you do about the United States and the repudiation of the Geneva Conventions or the establishment of detention facilities around the world, many of which were unaccountable? What do you do about torture? Not whether you support it or not, but how do you literally deal with it? Do you denounce it? Or do you try to get a meeting with President Bush? He chose the meeting, as he would always do, and actually manage somehow to raise Guantanamo, torture the International Criminal Court with the president, and yet leave President Bush impressed with him as the one man in the UN system Bush thought he could do business with. And how did he do that? Well, he started the meeting first by Bush said hello and touched Sergio's shoulders, and Sergio's a kind of a fit guy, and Bush was like, wow, you must work out. So they spent 3 minutes talking about their workout. I kid you not. This is 2 weeks before the war in Iraq. And but then Sergio, here recurrent for a second, but always with his own, in this instance, human rights objectives in mind, but he leads the meeting by boasting about the shoot-to-kill policy that he put in place in East Timor to deal with Indonesian militia who were coming in and murdering civilians. And this, and his assistant, Jonathan Prentice, a British guy, passed a note to one of his colleagues and said, did the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, my friend, hero, and boss, Sergio, really just boast to George Bush about his shoot-to-kill policy? But it was, of course, tactical, and it also happened to be true. He did put that policy in place after years of passivity in which UN peacekeepers were seen to stand idly by in the face of violence against civilians. Sergio decided to try to send a signal to the killers very early on. And unlike now what's been going on in Timor the last year or so, it looks in retrospect certainly as if the militants were deterred by this much more aggressive posture and much more aggressive set of rules of engagement. Unfortunately, by charming Bush or by convincing him that he was convincing Bush that Sergio was reasonable, what that meant was that after the United States invaded Iraq in March of 2003, again a couple weeks after this meeting, and the question arose as to whether a UN mission would deploy in the wake of the coalition to try to offer expertise on how to actually do nation building and try to supply humanitarian aid and try to identify political leaders and so forth who weren't part of the exile community that was already in a sense in bed with the Bush administration. It was a question of who do you send? And Bush only had one guy that he could fix that he fixated on, and that was that guy Sergio. We got, what about that guy Sergio? He had the shoot to kill policy in East Timor. And lo and behold, Bush and Rice put a huge amount of pressure on Kofi Annan. Sergio did not want to go to Iraq. All the missions I've described, Sergio embraced, and he loved being in the field. He, again, was a flame chaser in that way. and also a flame chaser in terms of the flames of idealism. I mean, the flame of idealism. He really believed in being in those places that he could make a difference. He wasn't always right that he could make a difference, but he believed that. In the case of Iraq, he knew there was no difference to be made. He really believed that the Americans were not yet ready to take the advice of even someone like him who had just very technical insights on elections, on constitutions, on transitional justice, on policing, law and order, demobilization of army soldiers, reconstruction, utilities. I mean, this is stuff the United States military hadn't thought about in decades. These were not skills that we had embedded in our forces, and we were not, of course, making use of at least some of the resources that existed in the State Department and so forth. So it was clear that the needs were out there, but it was not at all clear that the Americans, who were doing, in their own mind, very well in Iraq at that point, this was mission accomplished time. This was right around that time. You had looting. You had attacks against U.S. forces, but you had no attacks against civilians, no sectarian violence, no suicide bombers, no evidence of al-Qaeda. It was a very, very different time. And because the United States felt things were going okay, that, of course, made the Americans less likely to listen to the U.N., thinking that they could figure it out on their own. So Sergio called Annan, actually his chief of staff, and said, take me off the list. I don't want to be on the short list. But if you're Annan and the U.N. has just been bypassed in the run-up to Iraq, and you, of course, wish well upon the Iraqis and want to maximize their odds of getting through this in a stable and peaceful and humane way, you look around your roster and you say, well, who else am I going to send? And Sergio said, send somebody junior. Don't legitimate this invasion, this occupation, and so forth by sending somebody who's, you know, and Sergio wouldn't have said this, but basically one promotion away from becoming Secretary General of the UN. And Annan completely understandably said, but you're the only guy who can take the little, whatever daylight there is, whatever, at the moments where the Americans are struggling, you're the guy in the room who can convince them to make the UN relevant again and can convince them to listen to this, again, very practical knowledge that you can bring to bear. And because Annan asked, Sergio could not say no, and he went to Iraq. The only mission, again, that I encountered that he went to reluctantly. Now, in going, he had a pretty frustrating summer. He tried to get Bremer to scale back the debathification order, which gutted the Iraqi infrastructure and administration of Ba'ath Party officials. He tried to get the demobilization of the Iraqi army reversed so that the Iraqi soldiers who'd been put out on the streets somehow would be reintegrated into some kind of entity. And most crucially, himself having probably hoarded power too long in East Timor, he tried to convince Bremer that if in East Timor, a tiny little island nation, the Timorese resented a UN occupation, then surely this proud, if broken, Iraq, this country of 40 million people, was going to recoil at the coalition's occupation. And he told Bremer, you know, if you hoard power, you will hoard blame. Anything that goes wrong then will be you will be held responsible for that. And tried to convince Bremer to make the Governing Council, that early body, actually a governing body, where the Americans were there offering assistance, but the Iraqis were in charge. He failed. On August 19th, 2003, Sergio and others were in the UN base in Baghdad. It was lightly guarded, partly on purpose. It was actually a space that Sergio prided himself on making accessible. Again, no civilian attacks at that time, no suicide attacks, nothing like it. So now it looks very dumb what he did. But at the time, it was in keeping with the security protocols for humanitarian organizations. He wanted it to be the anti-green zone where Iraqis could come and file their grievances and check their emails and do, you know, whatnot. And truck bomber pulled up right outside Sergio's office, the most vulnerable office in the whole building. His security guards had asked him to move 2 weeks before the attack, but he said, what am I going to put, like, some junior official in this office? And the security bodyguard's like, And Zerge said, no, I don't think so. So he stayed in that office, not feeling hugely vulnerable at that point, but still, obviously, that the question was raised was a testament to the deterioration that was going on. The bomb went off. About 20 people died within the first hour of the explosion. Miraculously, Sergio and a man named Gil Loescher, an American, survived. They were in the office together. The bomb was right outside the window. How either of them survived is beyond me. And they were thrust backwards, landed almost sort of head down, legs up, pinned under the rubble. Appallingly, although the administration had predicated the war in Iraq, at least in part, on a link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, or Saddam Hussein and large-scale terrorist attack against civilian targets, again, appallingly, no planning had been done to respond to large-scale terrorist attacks against civilian targets, and this was the first. So the U.S. military, although there were incredible acts of bravery and heroism on that day, lacked a search and rescue capacity. There was no designated unit that would get created the next day on August 20th as a result of this attack. There was none of the kind of equipment you would need to cut the concrete, cut the rebar within the concrete that was pinning Sergio down. Not even basic plywood that he was in a 30-foot shaft with this other American, Gil. And not even to, you know, to be able to shore up the wall so when you went in as a rescuer you could be confident that, you know, some, or at least somewhat confident that the rubble would not crash down on you as well. So these Americans went in. Amazingly, they were, had no radios, no capacity, no map of the building. There was just nothing. And one of them found a lady's handbag, one of those basket handbags in one of the offices. Another person found a curtain rope. They tied the curtain rope to the handbag, and they created a pulley system. This is what we brought to bear to try to rescue Sergio and Gil. One of the rescuers was able to saw off Gil Loescher's legs and... and rescue him. He's now alive and well in Oxford, and an incredible refugee advocate, human rights advocate before this occurred, and as I'll share here in a minute, even more so since. Sergio was alive for 3.5 hours and awaited rescue, was conversant for the first two, loquacious even, asking about other members of his team and how they were expecting rescue, but in the end must have had some recognition before he lost consciousness that the most powerful superpower in the history of mankind was using a lady's handbag and a curtain rope in order to rescue him. Just before I sort of pull back and just give you a couple lessons before I close here about his life and what I think we can learn from it as a country, I just want to read you just a little passage. I actually don't like readings generally, but this is powerful, sort of the survivors. Sergio had been a ladies' man much of his life, but he and had been married and had two kids and been away in order to do a lot of these missions away from his family. And perhaps because he was reaching the pinnacle of the UN, perhaps because he was just getting older and having a midlife crisis, I don't know, he decided to sort of end those inconsistencies in his life. He had met a woman in East Timor that he fell in love with, an Argentine woman, and they were engaged. His divorce had not yet come through, but she was with him in Baghdad and was in an office across the hall from his. So her name is Carolina, and she tried to rescue him and get Americans to go to him, but of course there was no equipment. It was going to be very hard to do. So I'm just going to read a small, short passage about the aftermath of the bomb. I mentioned Gil Loescher, who was with him in the hole, in the shaft. Gil Loescher, the only person who survived the meeting in Vera de Mello's office, was flown to Landstuhl, Germany, and given a 25% chance of making it. Building upon Andre Valentine, the rescuer's primitive but life-saving sawing procedure, the doctors in Germany amputated both of Loescher's legs above the knee. On September 2nd, Loescher regained enough consciousness to begin mouthing words and asking about the pain in his legs. But only in late September, more than a month after the attack, did he realize he had been permanently handicapped. "Now I have no knees, right?" he asked his daughter. For more than a year after the attack, tiny shards of glass would work themselves free from his skin. His face was badly scarred, and he initially had no use of his right hand, but he made remarkable progress reacquiring the use of his hand and mastering computer-assisted prosthetic legs. He returned to the book he had been writing on protracted refugee crises And in 2006, he managed to travel to the northern Thai border to interview Burmese refugees. In one of the camps, he made a special point of trying to visit an out-of-the-way care center for disabled refugees run by Handicap International. But after wheeling himself across the camp, he found that the facility had been built atop a steep mud bank that his wheelchair could not ascend. Resigned to turning back, he suddenly saw five Burmese faces peering down at him from atop the bank. The Burmese, each of whom had a wooden prosthetic leg, made their way down the bank, raised Lusher's wheelchair onto their shoulders, and carried him up the hill. Lusher divides his existence into his first life and his second life. He says that on occasions when he's tempted to feel sorry for himself, he thinks about all that was lost on August 19th, including his close friend Arthur Helton. He also thinks about refugees. My whole career, I've been visiting refugee camps, and without realizing it, I was getting tutorials about resilience. If they can bounce back, I certainly can. He says he has his blue periods, but he doesn't ascribe those to his injuries. There's plenty to feel blue about in the world, he says. While Lusher lives with the visible scars of the attack, Vera de Mello's bodyguards endure the ghosts of August 19th. Gabby Pichon, the French close protection officer who was just 20 feet away from his boss when the bomber struck, says his dreams are haunted by his failure to save the man entrusted to him. Why him and not me, he asks. I have flashbacks. It's not like a TV that you can turn off. I don't have a remote control. Gamal Ibrahim, the Egyptian who guarded Vera de Mello in East Timor and for the first 2 months in Iraq, removed himself from the UN's close protection roster after the bomb and transferred to the canine unit. I never want to get close to anybody I'm protecting again, he says. Working with a dog is fine for me. Alain Chergui, who on Vera de Mello's insistence had taken leave 5 days before the bomb, is convinced he would have found a way to save his boss. He can't forgive himself for being absent when it mattered most for Vera de Mello, for the UN, and for the world. If I weren't married, he says, I would probably be dead by now. I would have shot myself, maybe. Protecting Sergio was what I was there to do. It was all I was there to do. Jonathan Prentice and Carol Ray, Vera de Mello's special assistant and secretary, who'd gone on leave with Chergui just days before the bomb, live with the knowledge that their replacements, Rick Hooper and Ramillo Buenaventura, died at desks that they normally occupied. After their boss's death, they remained at the office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, partly as a way of staying close to Sergio's memory. I'm not sailing quite so close to the sun as I did when I rode Sergio's coattails, Prentice says, but maybe that's not as important as I once thought it was, or as Sergio thought it was. Martin Griffiths, who became Vera de Mello's friend late in life, had left the UN in 2000 to run the Henri Dunant Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva, where he serves as a mediator among war combatants. Glad to be free of the shackles of UN red tape and politicking, he believes Vera de Mello was himself on a path toward reconciling his personal and professional ambitions. Sergio had devoted his life to the ideals and organization of the UN, and the countries in it had failed and disappointed him just as much as they had enriched and glorified him, Griffiths observes. The thing about Sergio was his youth. He still wanted what youth wants. He was getting more and more impatient about the half-measures he had. His tragedy was not his death. That was our tragedy. His tragedy was that he never finally arrived at that state of equilibrium that adults call happiness. Briefly, what I take from this life for us, because not all of us are going to get to grow up and be James Bond or Bobby Kennedy, are just a few very quick takeaways. I'll just do four here in closing. One, we are talking such a good game about global threats and transnational challenges and global warming and terrorism and proliferation and all these things, and we're exactly right, finally, to be developing a discourse in our culture that sees challenges not in just a statist way, but the models that we have offered our students, our foreign service officers, our soldiers, our citizens are, for the most part, 20th century models. They are statist models. They are generals or statesmen. We don't have many actors, I think Sergio's one, but I know there are others out there, who cross borders like the challenges themselves, or who operate at a sub-state or, again, transnational level. I think that has to change somehow. Christina mentioned the documentary film that She's helping produce, which is part of an enterprise that we're all a part of, which is to almost like Sergio Inc. to take Sergio. There's a book, there's the doc, there's a Hollywood, hopefully, motion picture that Terry George, the director of Hotel Rwanda, is directing. Not sure when that will be out. It's Hollywood, but it looks very promising. The idea is to take this figure, not because, again, people will join the UN as such, but because the challenges that he's bumping up against are the ones that we simply have to get better at dealing with. So I mentioned earlier that to a group we had dinner with, but that Paul Farmer might be another example of someone who's in this space, you know, who we've all learned so much from in the last 5 or 10 years. There've got to be others, but we have to think more about whether we're tailoring our learning for what lies ahead. Second, Sergio, as I've indicated, always talk to the harm doers, the evil doers, the adversaries, as we put them in our domestic political culture. He thought that this was the best way to get intelligence, to neutralize these individuals, to see if there were slivers of common ground. He just thought that if you're a pain causer, you can potentially abstain from that behavior. And more often than not, he was on his own, Sergio, in the field, didn't have the backing of powerful governments behind him, so it wasn't like there was anyone there to get rid of the pain causers. So he was, in a sense, in a way, forced into the room. But in his Serbio phase, he went too far. He went to that place that some people who prize negotiations with harm doers go to, where one feels that just that getting in the room is an end in itself, and that one sort of checks one's principles at the door. And I think in Sergio's life, we see him grappling with the balance of, on the one hand, this comes up in our domestic political debate, of course, being in the room, but understanding that being in the room doesn't mean you leave your toughness at the door. You know, if Obama talks to Ahmadinejad, the plan is not to not mention Holocaust denial or uranium enrichment or support for terrorism. It's indeed to go into the room with a purpose of hopefully maybe making progress, but that's hard to imagine with that regime right now. But then to leave the room and then to stand a much better chance of mobilizing an international coalition to contain Iran than one would have if the world got confused and thought the United States was the problem, rather than Iran, again, in the context of these issues. So figuring out what that balance is, but understanding that we have to disaggregate the so-called evildoers that have been lumped together, I think, very counterproductively in the last few years. Third point, Sergio, I've indicated a few of his sort of mistakes, or when one looks back and says, God, we would have done things differently, but one of the things he never got wrong was dignity. And we in our foreign policy, I think, don't do dignity very well. You may have noticed, wow, we have a dignity constituency here. But by dignity, I mean, it may be the obvious, but just disaggregating the human in human rights. When you talk about democracy or self-determination, you don't do it in a way that it sounds like you think you're the self that gets to determine, which is sometimes what we do in our democracy promotion. Thinking about the self-respect, the cultural identities, somehow, and again, this isn't about pure deference where your own interests become hostage to someone else's, but it's seeing the individuals and where they're coming from in a way, and recognizing them, and just as a check, I think, on some of the more, again, counterproductive impulses in American foreign policy, keeping dignity in mind. I think it would be quite transformative, actually, in foreign policy. And then fourth, final point, nobody, I think, was more aware than Sergio, having been in all these dangerous places and negotiated with all these killers, sort of how hard it was to do good in the world, how hard it was to make a difference or stop genocide or shore up a failing state. And yet, and he was completely humbled. He, you know, this cocky young guy got really chastened and humbled by his years in the world. The longer he was out there, the more he knew how little he knew. But the humility didn't paralyze him or immobilize him. It made him learn more languages, reach out to wider, more diverse groups of local leaders and so forth. He understood the complexity, but it made it just, it sort of was a new challenge for him as to how you grapple with complexity. I think we in this country, maybe I'm projecting here, but there's a temptation now amid our crisis of confidence and crisis of competence to say, oh, you know, we don't even know what we're doing. Let's just stay home. We feel so ignorant, like our tools are just not, again, tailored for this moment. And I think one of the things Sergio said was there's no such thing in the 21st century as a distant crisis. We know that's true by virtue of television, but also in terms of what does cross borders. And I think it would be myopic to think that an option available to us going forward is non-engagement. The issue is not whether to engage. It is, in fact, how to engage. And whether we engage thinking about the dignity of those we're engaging with, talking to our foes or adversaries or people with whom we have differences, freeing ourselves from the politics of fear, I think that has been very crippling here, and educating ourselves using models who've actually been in the world the last few decades, learning about violence and how to deal with that. I think those are some of the ingredients, anyway, for a more constructive approach. Why don't I leave it there, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you for... Thank you. Thanks. I'm told there are microphones, so I'm just going to call on you, and then the microphone person will come to you. There's a gentleman there on the left side. And then will someone raise a hand on the right side, and then we can get a head start? Yeah, so that.
Thank you very much for your compelling presentation. You alluded to the influence of the Security Council. What's your opinion of the proposals voiced by, I think, Tom Friedman and some others to bring the Security Council into the 21st century by removing those countries of past influence like England and especially France and replacing them with countries of populations of current influence such as Brazil and especially India to counterbalance the influence of China?
Gareth Evans, who's the former foreign minister of Australia and the president of the International Crisis Group, says of the permanent members of the council, the five countries that I mentioned, you mentioned, that the Security Council is comprised of two 19th century powers, two 20th century powers, and one 21st century power. You can guess which is where. I don't think that's fully right, but there is, I mean, the council is not only clogged at present because the greater multipolarity in the world, the rise of China, the resurgence of Russia, the erosion of influence of the United States in the last few years in terms of its ability to get what it wants internationally, that you now have three countries on the council who see the world very differently in terms of economic interests, human rights, national security, and so forth. And that's even leaving aside the Europeans on the council. So right now you have a kind of dysfunction. Then you have the issue you raise, which is representativeness and the anachronism, and Garrett's point, you know, these are the World War II victors plus France. I don't think the council can, that there's a chance that the council can thrive or even endure as a credible 21st century body. So I completely agree with Friedman. I agree with the need to alter membership, et cetera, but we have a structural problem, Mr. Watson, which is that each of the five councils want to keep all the power they have, each of the five powers on the council, and they all have the damn veto. So that's, you know, one of the things that happened that sort of undermines support for these initiatives. This comes back to, again, what the UN is a gathering of self-interested governments, principally. Is you had Britain and France saying, no, you go. No, 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 you go. No, we're staying. No, 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 you go. And then a discussion about whether there couldn't be a European Union seat, and then that got caught up in what the European Union is, which is not an obvious there's not an obvious answer for that. So that got caught up. And then your idea of then Friedman, everybody's ideas about Brazil, that was fine by Brazil and by people like me and you and certainly Sergio, the Brazilian. But the Argentines didn't love it. India, you know, a part of Chindia in the terms of the economic powerhouse, that was great for India. China didn't mind, amazingly, which was its own thing. But Pakistan, no way. So it's going to be very difficult just overcoming. You had South Africa and Nigeria battling for the African slot. You know, in the end, this is why, you know, people say, is this a book about the UN? And I think, well, not really. Yes, he's a UN guy, and you, I hope, learn about the UN system in a way that one never has. But it's really a book about the challenges and the problems we all have to deal with. And if we decide we care about dealing with global warming or care about failing states or violence or genocide, and a number of countries come together and make those commitments and are willing to give something up on behalf of those principles, you'll see the UN system will work much more functionally. So similarly, if some of the countries that I've just mentioned decided that they cared about the viability of the Council, then you'd see more give. And I don't know how broken and dysfunctional it has to get, and by that I mean the Council, not the UN as a whole, which I think is still doing a lot of really important work. But the Council of late is really not in an impressive phase. And part of it is legitimacy and representativeness, but part of it is the standoff among the powers. So global warming is not going to get handled through the Council until China and the United States decide, not just at a rhetorical level, but they want to deal with carbon emissions. There's no UN fix for global warming until that happens. And even if you didn't have a UN, you'd still have China and the United States not grappling yet with carbon emissions with an ambition, or India for that matter, at an ambition we're talking about. So I'm all for the proposal, but it's going to have to get grappled with at a domestic political level in enough countries where there's a willingness to sacrifice, and I don't see that sacrifice coming by having abstract discussions about Security Council reform or the United Nations or multilateralism. I wish that were enough, but I think it'll have to come around what's the thing we care about dealing with, and then, okay, now what are the institutions we have to adapt in order to deal with the thing, if you see what I mean. It's just a different sequencing of how one thinks about institutional reform. Yes, this woman is here. Yeah.
Hi. I have a selfish question, but I think everyone in here might have the same thing. I'm wondering if you could share any insights into how Barack Obama feels about humanitarian causes, military engagement, the UN, multilateralism, because he spent 14 months with him.
Longer. 15 on the campaign. I worked in his office in 2005 and 2006. I told a story at dinner earlier about how I met Obama, and just the short version of it is that he read A Problem from Hell. He was elected in November 2004. He read A Problem from Hell. Poor Michelle. But over the Christmas break, apparently, right after winning, probably the last vacation they had, and there he is reading a 600-page book on genocide. A lot of fun. And I had never met him before, but having read it, he had his schedule reach out to me and ask if I was going to be in Washington anytime soon and would I meet. So that was my first window into his sensibility, his disposition, what he read for pleasure. this is, again, if I had other experience of U.S. senators calling me up having read the book and wanting to discuss it, I would say, oh, he's just like any old U.S. senator who cares a lot about these issues. But it was the first time it had ever happened. Never had a government official call me, and haven't had one call me since. And, you know, he was kind of already, he wasn't going to be president at that time, but he was something of a big deal in that he was the, after Kerry lost, sort of the person that people were projecting all their fantasies onto, and all their hope for the future of the Democratic Party. So I met with him, and the reason I left my job at Harvard and moved to Washington, packed up my car, packed a car up. I actually had, for years, I've been trying to get season tickets to the Red Sox, and some of you know that's not easy to do, and I had just gotten a slice of a package, a season ticket package. I had 10 games, terrible sort of quasi-obstructed view seats, terrible seats, but thrilling. And I had just gotten the tickets, and I put them up on the fridge, and then I went down. I said, oh, I'm going to meet with that senator who's a great speaker, and went down and met with him and had this meeting that was supposed to be an hour and that lasted for 4 hours. And heard myself say, why don't I leave Harvard and come down and work in your office? And be an intern or answer phones or do whatever. And he's like, are you serious? And I said, yeah, absolutely. When can I start, kind of thing. And it was only when I got back to Winthrop, my home in near Boston, I remember then there were the tickets on the fridge. I was like, Obama. And now I have whole new reasons for saying Obama. I used to be an author and not the author of a comment. Anyway, what I found in the Senate in that year and what I found on the campaign is an acute, visceral regard for a point I made about dignity, which is pretty unusual because it's sort of that's a deep point. And I don't know if that comes from working in the inner city, if it comes from being an African-American, if it comes from living in Indonesia as a boy or having your grandmother barefoot in a hut in Kenya. I have no idea where it comes from. It's overdetermined in his case. One of the most profound points I think he's made that hasn't really gotten picked up is his discussion of democracy promotion and how for a long time we viewed democracy promotion as electocracy. You know, how we support elections, spend so much more money on elections than we do on the preconditions for elections that are actually stabilizing. So we treat elections, he always says this, as a starting line, like we show up and we're like, all right, here are the ballots, let's go, and not understanding that, you know, elements like Hamas benefit in free elections if there's no security, if lawlessness is prevalent. You're going to go, sadly, I mean, we know what it's like in this country, even when you're afraid, the tendency to lunge, you know, for people who you think will make you secure, even if there's not a past record of that happening. And election after election has seen radicals prevail in circumstances of lawlessness because they're often armed and, again, create the illusion of security. So there's got to be a lot more work done in rule of law promotion. And that's been one of the things that unites, I think, a lot of the issues that you mentioned in your question, multilateralism, humanitarian, genocide prevention, et cetera. It's just, you know, it's got to be foundational. We've never, the United States or the UN system and the governments within it, have never undertaken an ambitious rule of law initiative beyond, like, sending Sandra Day O'Connor to do a PowerPoint presentation in Warsaw in the wake of the fall of the wall. We're not serious. We're not working with police. We hate the thought of working with police. Jails. I mean, these are, no donor would touch them, you know, because of the risks, of course. But police are, in so many developing countries, a tool of terror and repression and not of, or corruption and not of rights enforcement. So the ingredients for societies to help themselves are not there. Anyway, this is a point he makes again and again. Or we treat elections as a finish line. So they flash the purple finger, you know, or the proverbial, I mean, we spend so much money on elections. Congo, we just had an election a year ago. And then that's it. We've had the election. That's the photo op. And our support, just when the spoilers are at large and the stakeholders have been identified and diminished or elevated, when I say we, I mean the UN system, governments within it, not just the United States, but we're out of there. We've done the... So I think that's a key component. The way he's developed a responsible withdrawal plan for Iraq, this was when I was... Last June, he said, I'm really sick of this debate, the way that, you know, on the right or wherever one wants to look, McCain says, if we leave, it's going to make Iraq's going to make Rwanda look like a picnic, that line. But no account of how by staying... We're dealing with civilian protection long term. We're actually building a political process that will stabilize the country. And it's the finger in the dike theory, and maybe something will come along. Like, but not rooted, in fact, in Iraqi welfare in the way that is necessary. And then, of course, people want to leave, understandably, saying, "Well, you know, since the harm followed the U.S. invasion, and since we have 1,000 good reasons to leave from the standpoint of U.S. troop welfare and U.S. national security and anti-Americanism and regional interests and global interests and so forth, so many reasons to leave, well, we tell ourselves that since we brought the harm, then when we leave, the harm will leave." And Barack's like, you know, we have to leave for all the – we have plenty of reasons to leave. We can go into them. But in leaving – in what we hear is probably the 16 to 18 months it'll take to get combat brigades out, can we kindly make Iraqis part of the conversation about how we leave? And so he, you know, propose, again, it's forever ago, and I don't think people are even aware of it, but a massive refugee assistance plan for Iraq's neighbors. The borders are closed. The Jordanian border, the Syrian border are closed. Why? Because they've been inundated with 2 million refugees, and there's been almost no support from the U.S. government or from other governments in the U.N. system. Obama at least gets to go and say, I, like you, oppose the war in Iraq. Now, do you want to moan about that? Bush is gone, you know, or do you want to actually help Jordan, Syria, deal with the load, the refugee load, Iran even, and think about now how people in flight are actually able to get to safe refuge if they're rendered more vulnerable in certain communities by our departure. Let's have that conversation. Let's have an adult global conversation about Iraqi welfare that doesn't have everybody just pointing their finger at the United States, but actually has others taking responsibility for this issue. Create a war crimes commission. Are we even curious about why people are cleansed from their homes or who's cleansed them? Do we have a list of most wanted or at least a potential to put a stigma, as we do for Darfur, on those who are involved in these militia groups? Or can they just travel freely? Like, why aren't they on an Interpol list? Well, in part because we're dependent on them in our security efforts, but surely a little more curiosity can at least create the impression that people are being watched in the interim as we withdraw. Fair notice to Iraqis, so they're involved, in fact, in the planning process of getting out. And if civilians want to move from mixed neighborhoods to homogenous neighborhoods, maybe some assistance in terms of transport. I mean, it's all terrible to have to talk in these terms. And even these steps are incommensurate, of course, to the tragedy unfolding, but it, you know, we're not in a realm of good options here. And yet to pretend that the Iraqi humanitarian problem doesn't exist and we just get to leave and voila, that's also irresponsible, and it's not going to help U.S. security long-term if refugees are flowing into countries and they're, you know, firing at them in order to keep them away, and all the countries in the neighborhood are fragile in terms of their demographic balances and so forth. So that's just an example, I think, of the way that he thinks and gets away from the false dichotomies and at least behind the scenes, you know, gets at some of the nitty-gritty, you know, at a very, very granular level. And I saw that in my first dinner, and I've seen it in every policy discussion I've been in with him since on these questions. Yes, sir. I don't know where the mic is now, but, yeah, in the middle there. Yeah.
I have two questions.
Well, you need to wait for the mic. And, okay, you can go first. I was actually pointing the guy behind you, but you can go first, and then – no, you go first, and then we'll do the gentleman behind you. And then.
Your mention of Lebanon reminds me of the response to the truck bombing, which killed 200 and more Marines by President Reagan, which was to withdraw the Marines from Lebanon. And it prompts me to ask your evaluation of the Reagan Secretary of Navy, Jim Webb, now a Democratic senator from Virginia, the successful campaign as a populist, the remarkable early notorious conversation with Bush, his remarkable response to the State of the Union delivered for the Democrats in the Senate. I want to ask your evaluation of him as a vice presidential candidate.
Yeah, I got nothing here. I mean, I don't. That's not me now having learned my lesson and learning how to. It's just I. He seems. I mean, all those credentials seem impressive. We obviously have to think very carefully about our ability to make a very strong national security case at a time when national security is on people's minds. And he seems compelling. I mean, that CV is compelling for the moment. But I know absolutely nothing. I worked with Senator Obama on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Webb was, I believe he's on Armed Services, if I'm not mistaken, but maybe, or Veterans or whatever, which Obama's on as well, but I just happened not to work with him on Veterans issues. So I have no, and there's no conversation. I mean, this I can say, that is so far beyond where Obama is. It must be very far beyond where Senator Clinton is, although Bill Clinton said Obama would make a good vice president, which was very nice of him. McCain has the luxury now of being able to think about this and vet and, you know, experiment with different models. But this is just, I mean, I've never heard Obama get beyond, there's been such a discipline. When people ask about his executive experience, he obviously doesn't have a lot of executive experience, but I look at this, watching this campaign unfold, and the iron discipline of raising the money in the way that he did, which now seems so obvious. Oh, of course, he's a good fundraiser. Well, why exactly? You know, how did that happen that he got this network into gear that he's, you know, 70% of his money comes from people who've given less than $300, like who can give again? And the network of organizers and the turnout and just the operation he has managed as a kind of CEO of a campaign, combined with the kind of almost morale discipline that he had to exhibit in those dark months where he was 25%, 40% initially behind in the polls, and just saying, you don't understand, I'm running for president of Iowa, president of Iowa, president of Iowa, president of Iowa, and people saying, but you're 40% behind the polls and we've raised all this money for president of Iowa, I'm going to be president of Iowa. And the grief he got, I mean, he was 25%, 30% behind on January 1st of this year. Wasn't it just April Fool's Day? January, February, March. 3 months ago, 25 to 30% in the polls, behind in the polls. And in Iowa, you know, he was gaining and, you know, going into the election neck and neck, of course, with Edwards and Clinton. But just the way that he has kept his eye, and that is not going to change now that it looks a little closer, you know, where he's going to start thinking, you know, playing with vice presidential candidates in his mind. It's kind of block by block. Allentown is what's on his mind. Yes, sir, I think behind, yeah.
In your opening statement, you were obviously eager for someone to ask you a question about Zimbabwe. And so here it is. If you were in a position of authority and you could act out some fantasy for how you could improve the future of Zimbabwe and encourage Mr. Mugabe to leave, how would you do it? What would be your methodology?
Well, I think one of the really important, I mean, this sounds very platitudinous, but important part of thinking about American foreign policy going forward is to not simply think about what would I, Samantha, most want to see happen in Zimbabwe, and therefore, and then how should I, Samantha, get involved to make that happen? But to ask, what do I most want to happen in Zimbabwe or any place else, and what would the effect of an American intervention be on the goal that I have? What would the effect of my particular event, or Obama's, or Clinton's, or McCain's, or whatever? That is, you know, to move into a much more effects-based approach. And I mean, of course, if you're in the State Department, you're saying, well, of course, that's what we do all the time. But I don't think that is done nearly enough. I think you get these surges of moralism and surges of regard for the people of Zimbabwe, and then, you know, an impulse like to speak out, a denunciation, some kind of intervention. We don't have economic leverage because of the sanctions and so forth. But I think we need to be more conscious of who that involvement should best come from. And so that leads me to say two things, one Zimbabwe-related and one U.S. foreign policy-related. Our standing to be useful in Zimbabwe, our standing has to improve dramatically on moral and human rights issues in order for us to be heard as a good faith intervener, mediator, et cetera, in Zimbabwe. And I'll get to Zimbabwe specifically in a second, but in a global world, you just can't sort of be useful on Zimbabwe on a Monday and endorse waterboarding on a Tuesday, or denounce the stolen election or the, you know, the land seizures or whatever on a Monday. It's called waterboarding a no-brainer on a Tuesday, and then go to the UN and say, okay, now who's with us in the contact group for Zimbabwe? It's harder now. There's always been inconsistencies, but these cleavages are just much more exposed in the international system. So if I were dealing with Zimbabwe, I would have to be dealing with someone else who was dealing with Guantanamo and rendition and torture and getting out of Iraq responsibly. That is, we have to be enhancing our ability to be helpful to the people we most want to help. And I say that because I know Morgan Tsvangirai a little bit, who's just won the election, and have talked to him at length about American help and so forth. And he's like, you know, thanks but no thanks. Like, this is a gift to Mugabe if it's another colonial, imperial intervention seen to be that or comparable as that. I mean, that's what Mugabe has done to his opposition always anyway. And this, what I'm saying about the United States also applies even more dramatically because of the history with regard to Britain, where there's been a lot of, because of the connection, much more civic outrage there, domestic outrage in that country than in Britain, that is, than there has here. And yet Blair, because of Iraq and because of the colonial past, having a hard time being as useful as he would like to be. So one of the reasons Zimbabwe has rotted for so long in the last 4 or 5 years under this not only tyrannous, tyrannical rule, but, you know, economically just, I mean, disastrous destruction. I wrote a piece for The Atlantic Monthly entitled How to Destroy a Country in 10 Easy Steps by Robert Mugabe. Literally about how the thread came out of the sweater and how he began, because it's not obvious why the father of independence would then go to these places he's gone to, and so sort of how it happened, and that was a couple of years ago, and it's just persisted since then. But we have left it with busy with the war on terror, so-called, or busy with Iraq. We've said, okay, well, South Africa has more standing, but South Africa hasn't had the regard for human rights or the regard for Zimbabweans that has mattered. So we have a structural world order problem now in that there's a void on human rights leadership. So I would deal, somehow have in an administration, you'd have to deal with these other issues, walk and chew gum at the same time, while also, I think, now working behind the scenes and asking who are the more credible actors. If Scandinavian countries, Japan, Mbeki now, who's going to have to deal with a massive refugee flow if this thing melts down. I mean, really, economic incentives for Mugabe, maybe even discussions of amnesty and things like that through the International Criminal Court, or, you know, that you bring in actors that themselves have leverage that is lacking. It sounds very laborious, I know, but unfortunately I think it's there's got to be a diplomatic contact group that has in it both powerful countries like ours, but who have legitimacy problems, and less powerful countries that are seen as less tainted right now in the international system to make Mugabe feel like he's in a vice, not only from the bottom within his country and the voters, but also from the sides. And China probably has to be part of that too, which is the gorilla in every room at present. Yes. Okay. Last question. Just this. Yes, young lady here. This is the last question.
Hi, thank you for joining us today. I was wondering about the lessons you drew from Sergio's life at the end of your talk about the need for international workers like Sergio and also the need not to be paralyzed. And I was wondering how you would respond to the frustration that many international workers face working in difficult situations where they feel that the same conflicts are recurring, that things are not getting better, and that the work that they are doing is not really moving things positively in a sustainable way.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's very hard. The old Fleet Street expression in Britain was, if it bleeds, it leads. So a lot of this is a perception. Some of it is just plain facts and the backsliding and how hard it is to make a difference. But some of it is just where the attention is in a given day. We focus on, a month ago, the burning U.S. embassy in Belgrade and say, here we go again in the Balkans, and we don't focus on the fact that nobody has died in Bosnia since 1995. That's 13 years after some of the most vicious fighting. We focus on the burned embassy and don't focus on the fact that, 1.5 million ethnic Albanians are living with relative autonomy. They may not use the autonomy well, but it's a very different circumstance than living under the jackboot of Serbian rule. In East Timor, we focus on the attempted assassination of José Ramos Horta, the Nobel Prize winner. I mean, a crushing testament to how much East Timor, even as an independent country, is struggling. And yet, you know, they've now negotiated an oil treaty with Australia. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, it's never clear with developing countries. But they have a major source of income now. Ramos Horta and Gusmão have been incredible democratic leaders. There have been peaceful transfers of power, and the Indonesians are long gone. I just think it's, again, maybe it allows me to come back to the point I made about our models, that, in Writing a Problem from Hell or writing this book, I try to understand when things don't work, why they don't work. So in reading Sergio's life, it's not a Pollyannish story about this hero who's, you know, everywhere he goes, he snaps his fingers and he makes things happen. It's literally what he's bumping up against when he's not getting where he wants, when he's not getting what he wants for civilians. But also a whole number of stories about, you know, again, how you make things happen and how you claim creativity within bureaucracies. And his is the biggest bureaucracy in the world, the UN, but aid workers are living with that as well. They're in the field. They're bumping up against the suffering. They're making their appeals to their national offices, to their donors. And, you know, one of the most gratifying things reads of this book so far came from a teacher. I often do panel discussions with teachers with Facing History and Ourselves. And one of them said, you know, when I read this book, I so identified with Sergio because, you know, I'm a teacher. And I was thinking, oh, and Sergio was a teacher of UN staff. And he's like, no. It's like I'm like him because I'm in the classroom and I have all these ideas for how we should fix things. And I'm bumping up against, like, kids who are going into gangs and they're not reading and they're not getting what they need. And I'm always torn, like, do I leave the classroom and go and work, you know, in policy somehow, in education policy? But then I lose touch with the people who it's all about. Or do I stay, you know, in the classroom, but I feel like I'm just dealing with symptoms and not with causes. And so it's incredibly, I mean, exactly the kind of read I would want, where Sergio's life is not just a model for how to deal with failing Afghanistan or East Timor, but in fact about this balance between, you know, being out there and doing individual good, which these aid workers who despair are doing every day in a camp. They're keeping people alive, but that sort of innate frustration that they're not, you know, that they're not themselves able to shift the priorities of member states, you know, who are the equivalent of, I don't know, school boards or voters or presidents and so forth. And so, you know, I think there's going to be a certain amount of despair, again, until our vocabulary changes and they start to get more wind at their back. But focusing on the success stories, the longer-term success stories that exist out there but just have to be identified, isolated, and better understood, how critical masses came together at appropriate times to improve human welfare. It doesn't happen often, but when it happens, by God, we better understand how the moons lined up. Thank you so much. I'll do a signing somewhere. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.